The Institute for Communication and Religion at Seton Hall University provides a nexus for ongoing scholarly exploration of communication topics critically important to religion and society. One especially critical juncture is the role of religion in our democratic process. To study the intersection of religion and politics, in 2020, the Institute hosted a series of expert presentations addressing religious issues in the historic Trump-Biden presidential race. We are proud to present these presentations here in podcast format, and we are grateful to the Lilly Fellows Program for their generous funding of this initiative.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Institute for Communication and Religion's Conference on the Intersection of Faith, Politics, and Rhetoric in the U.S. Presidential Election. My name is John Radwin, and I'm honored to serve as ICR Director and your host today. Sponsored by the Lilly Fellows Program, Seton Hall University is proud to present Communication and Religion in the 2020 U.S. Presidential Election, bringing together some of the foremost scholars in their fields to discuss and share their expertise with students, faculty, and the general public. Broadcast live to registrants across the country, the event will also be simulcast by Shemaru, a leading media and distribution company based in India. The views expressed at this conference are those of the participants. The university, Qua University, neither endorses nor opposes any candidate or political party, but in the grand tradition of academic inquiry and freedom, brings you this conference, its scholars and their views on what many have referred to as a critical juncture in both U.S. and world history. I am now happy to introduce today's third conference speaker, Dr. Joe Renee Formicola, PhD, Professor of Political Science. Dr. Formicola's field of expertise is church-state relations. While at Seton Hall University, she has published extensively on political and religious topics that deal with the relationship between the Catholic Church and the American government. She is the author of 5 books, Papal Policies on Clerical Sexual Abuse, Clerical Sexual Abuse, How the Crisis Changed the U.S. Church-State Relations, The Politics of Values, John Paul II, Prophetic Politician, and The Catholic Church and Human Rights. She is also the co-author of 2 additional books, The Politics of School Choice and Faith-Based Initiatives in the Bush Administration. Formicola has published extensively in peer-reviewed journals and currently serves on the editorial board of the Journal of Church and State. She is often seen on television sharing commentary on religious issues, especially those related to Catholicism, the papacy, and U.S. politics. Dr. Formicola will be speaking with us today on Catholics, the media, and the 2020 election for about 1 hour, and will be followed by about 15 minutes of Q&A with the audience. I now give you Dr. Joe Renee Formicola.
Hello, everyone. I'm very happy to be here today, especially following my colleague, Dr. Polito. We have offices next door to each other, but we have very different views on many things, and that's what makes our department so exciting and our work so enjoyable, because we can discuss things with each other and talk about them. As Dr. Radwin said, I am a specialist in church-state relations. That's essentially what I deal with. And over the years, because the expertise that I have developed deals with Catholic issues and government, I'll be talking today about the 2020 presidential election and the role that the Catholic vote or Catholic issues are involved here. Here we go. All right. So this was an article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal just about a week ago. And the question was, is the Supreme Court too Catholic? And it became a main and leading story that deals with Catholics and this presidential election. And when I put up this picture, I think you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Okay? It really was about, the article was about, is the Supreme Court too Catholic? And it was about the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. And so I thought we'd start with a few of the stories that involved Catholics this year before we actually get into talking about the role that Catholics play, the church, and whether or not Catholics are a voting bloc, etc. But this was a main story, still remains a a main story. In fact, I mean, I had hoped that they would take the vote today so I could have a lead story here to talk about. But I think we'll know in about 24 hours, maybe a day, how this is going to play out. So what are the political problems involved with this situation? First of all, Judge Barrett has been questioned about the fact that she lives her dogma. Does that mean she lives her faith? Is this a religious question? I don't know. The fact that she's involved in an organization called People of Praise, which I will be talking about in a little bit. The fact that there are those who are afraid that because of her religion, it might impact some voting on any abortion issue that might come up before the court. Again, because of her religion, will that have some impact on how she might vote on some sort of an issue that comes up regarding same-sex marriage or transgender people or other issues that involve individuals who are outside the area of Catholic doctrine? Climate change, which the Pope has written about, issues of health care and what that might mean, because the Catholic nuns in the past have brought a number of cases regarding the ACA, and the conservative values that she has. Okay, so that these are the political problems on the one hand. On the other hand, here they are, you know, an American Catholic family. Another case that's been in the news has involved Nick Sandman. Okay, I'm sure you recognize this young man. Okay. The newspapers have referred to him as the defamed MAGA hat Covington boy. He was at a pro-life march in Washington, D.C., and was looking at a Native American, and the press reported that he was smirking, and I guess I don't know why or how this story came to come out in the newspapers or in the traditional media as it did. But as a result, okay, he sued both CNN and the Washington Post for defamation, and he won his case for an undisclosed amount of settlement. Okay, so that Nick Sandman, who was a senior at a Jesuit high school, I don't know why he brought his suit or what his claim was, but here is Nick Sandman a year later. And Nick Sandman is now an outspoken person against the liberal media and gave a speech at the 2020 Republican National Convention. The new college that he's at, however, was very interesting the way he was treated. He became the object of being watched by a member of the faculty for his views, and the faculty member was forced to apologize for the fact that he was going to be watching this particular young man and what he said in class. Here's another picture that shows Cardinal Dolan of New York and the President of the United States. This was taken at the Al Smith dinner, not this year, but last year. Cardinal Dolan and the President seemed to get along very well. In fact, Cardinal Dolan was asked to open the Republican National Convention. One of the speakers at the RNC, besides Nick Sandman, was Sister Deirdre Byrne, a nun, a former army surgeon, who spoke about the unborn and refugees, and she was given a platform to speak. A lot of people felt that, you know, she should not have been allowed to speak, but this was another Catholic person at the Republican National Convention. Here's another story, the beheading of Catholic statues in various different places across the United States. Didn't get quite as much coverage as the previous stories. But again, you know, Catholics are involved by the very nature of who they are and what they are, what they stand for, how many there are. How about this one? Here is a picture of the president holding a Bible, being severely castigated by the Catholic Bishop of Washington, D.C., Bishop Wilton Gregory. These kinds of stories bring Catholics and Catholic ideas and Catholic issues before the public and before the press. So I'm going to talk today about Catholics, the media, and the 2020 presidential election. I'm going to talk about, first of all, how is the institutional church involved in politics? How is it that it's involved? And how are its adherents involved, and why does the Catholic Church think that it has a right to be politically involved? Here are a few demographics that we should perhaps recognize. First of all, depending upon where you look and the statistics that you get, we know that Catholics are between 21 and 23, sometimes 24% of the U.S. population. So they are a large demographic group within the United States. But when we use the term Catholic, okay, there are a variety of different kinds of people who identify as Catholic. So some are identify themselves as committed Catholics. That is, they attend Mass and they follow all of the Catholic doctrine and dogma. And there are those who consider themselves to be cultural Catholics. That means that they were educated in Catholic schools. They follow some of the traditions, but they don't necessarily attend Mass or follow a lot of doctrines, okay? And these are people that some people also refer to as cafeteria Catholics. They pick and choose what particular aspects of Catholicism they want to believe in or profess or follow or believe in. And then there are those non-practicing Catholics, or some people call them fallen away Catholics, but they still define themselves as Catholics. So that from what we can see right off the bat is that the whole idea that there is a Catholic vote is really a myth, okay? Because Catholics are not monolithic, okay? They have very different ways of thinking about their religion and who they are and what they are. And so to say that all Catholics are committed or cultural or whatever is not true. It is a myth, okay? We know that Catholics are cross-pressured. They make decisions based upon their education, their economics, their gender, their ethnicity. Okay, so that when we say Hispanic Catholics, there's a difference between the way Cuban Catholics vote versus Catholics from Mexico, okay, who are in the United States. There is a difference between people who are highly educated PhD Catholics versus people who went to high school, but in their high school, they didn't pursue any part of their religion or learn anything about their religion, etc. The economic structure of different groups of Catholics also plays a role. Their gender, women and men vote differently. And the question is, how big a part does Catholicism play when we're talking about who is a Catholic and what the Catholic demographics are? So when we talk about the church and its political role and what political role it might play in an Amy Barrett or in a Nick Sandman or in a relationship with the president of the United States, the political roles of the church are really very different from what the public thinks. Okay. The political roles of the church are essentially threefold. One, the church sees itself as a moral advocate for certain policies. The church sees itself as a non-ideological actor, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. And the church also must be a non-partisan actor for certain legal reasons. Okay, so I'm going to talk about these three things. What does the church see its role as, and how does it carry it out, and how does it function? So the Catholic Church, the institutional Catholic Church from top to bottom, okay, sees itself as a moral advocate. And it's a moral advocate for specific public policies. The advocacy is based on its own theology. So by moral advocate, the bishops have every year, every presidential year, write a document called Forming Consciences, and they believe that it's their role to help the laity to form their consciences about public policies, especially life issues. And they believe that it's their role to develop prudence and courage in people to stand up for their particular values. Okay, so number one, as a moral advocate, they think their job is to help form consciences. Secondly, they see it as their job to prioritize the whole notion of respect for human being. They would argue that the core of all Catholic moral and social teaching that comes into public debate really is based on human rights, human dignity, and the fact that all human beings are made in the image and likeness of God. And because they have this side of them which is like to God or divine, and that is part of them as well as their human or frail part, they are able to rise above themselves. They are able to be charitable. They're capable of being altruistic. They're capable of doing for their fellow man. They're capable of rising above themselves as human beings. And thirdly, they believe that it's their responsibility to teach about moral values. They see this whole notion of being a moral advocate or teaching about moral values as being central to their mission. This is what they believe they are about, that they need to bring their moral values into the marketplace, that by doing this, they enhance or enlarge the whole notion of pluralism, that they need to bring their particular values into the marketplace, and that they need to provide some sort of a moral consistency or framework or a way by which people can assess issues, by the way people can assess platforms, political platforms, or political campaigns, and that in doing this, they should be providing outreach to those in need. So when we talk about moral advocacy, the church is here talking about ways by which to advance public policies that are going to help people. And all of this is based on the church's own notion of its theology. So moral advocate is number one. In advocacy, moral advocacy can include education, and it can be include a certain amount of lobbying, which I'll talk about. But all of this advocacy is based on moral convictions and moral choices. So if the church is advocating for a particular policy, it's advocating for a particular policy based on its moral convictions and the moral choices that it expects political actors to make. Advocacy means that they're advocating on behalf of the dignity of the individual, on the fact that all people are worthy of respect and dignity, and that every type of advocacy for any kind of a policy, a public policy, should be based on the pursuit of the common good. What is for the good of all? Well, what will help the entire society and all people to fulfill themselves? And this includes a special protection for the weak and the vulnerable, or an option for the poor. So when you talk about moral advocacy, and when you talk about what is it that the church is trying to do in the public square or in the public arena, what is it trying to advance? It's trying to advance policies that are based on moral convictions, on dignity for the individual, on the pursuit of the common good, on the protection of the weak and the vulnerable, and the option for the poor. That's the first thing. The second thing is that the church is a non-ideological political actor. And when I talk about non-ideological, the speaker before me spent a long time talking about ideology, but the church doesn't involve itself in ideological arguments. It sees itself as a non-ideological political actor. And what does that mean? The church basically says, we don't involve ourselves in the ideology of the left or the ideology of the right. The church is neither liberal nor conservative. The church is based on the principles of Jesus Christ, and that means that it can take policies that some people believe are on the right and some people believe that are on the left, but these, they say, are the policies of Jesus Christ, and therefore you cannot nail the church down in the same way that you could nail down an ideological group of people. So on the one hand, the church supports pro-life and traditional family values, which some people would say is conservative. The church supports school choice, which a lot of people say is conservative. But on the other hand, the church supports welcoming the stranger and immigration reform, which a lot of people would say is liberal and progressive and on the left. The church supports the Affordable Care Act, which a lot of people would say is liberal, progressive, and on the left. The church supports creation care and environmental concerns. And where that falls, I leave that up to you. But you can see that the church doesn't really go to one side or the other in the ideological fighting that exists in the world, especially in the United States today. It says, no, we base our moral advocacy on the principles of Jesus Christ and not on the principles of political parties or ideological groups. And thirdly, the church is also a nonpartisan actor in politics. That means the church cannot and does not support any particular political party or political actor in a political campaign or race. The Catholic Church, and I have this in big bold, is not affiliated, nor can it affiliate with any political party because it has a tax-exempt status as a nonprofit organization. So if you look at the U.S. tax code, which wouldn't everybody just like to spend some free time reading the U.S. tax code? If you look at Section 501c3, which talks about nonprofit organizations, nonprofit organizations do not pay taxes to the federal government or to state governments for that fact, because they are performing specific jobs or services to the community. And in return, the government repays this service or this community action or behavior by not charging these institutions taxes. So Seton Hall does not pay taxes to the federal government or the state government. It's a 501c3. But that does put certain responsibilities for that tax-exempt status. And it means that it can lobby for a cause or a policy, but not for a specific individual or a party. That's what we mean by nonpartisan. It cannot say, Seton Hall University cannot say, you should vote for Joe Biden or you should vote for Donald Trump. No, because those would be partisan activities. Nor can Seton Hall University say, we support the Democratic Party or we support the Republican Party. Again, no, those would be partisan activities. So Seton Hall must and can lobby or educate about certain issues or advocate for certain issues that it believes are moral issues, but it cannot get involved in any partisan activity. The amount of lobbying or for a particular issue, advocating on behalf of a moral issue, is also limited by specific government regulations. The Catholic Church cannot spend 99% of its time lobbying on behalf of issues. It can spend a certain amount of time, but it's required that it do the service that it is supposed to be performing for the public good, for the common good, in dealing with other issues that are things that only they can deal with, or they can deal with more efficiently than the state. So the amount of lobbying is also limited by specific government regulations. Now, when we look at this and we suddenly say, well, who does this impact? Who are the people in the U.S. political process who would be impacted by all the kinds of things that we're talking about? Who are these Catholics? Let's just recognize this, that Nancy Pelosi, who was Speaker of the House, is a Catholic. And about 25% of the House of Representatives is Catholic. About 22% of the Senate is made up of Catholics. But the Speaker of the House is a Catholic. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, is a Catholic, as are four other justices, Alito, Thomas, Kavanaugh, Sotomayor, and Gorsuch, who was a Catholic but now attends a Protestant church, so I'm not going to include him in that. If Barrett is confirmed, she would be the sixth Catholic on the Supreme Court. The presidential candidate, Joe Biden, is a Catholic. The vice presidential candidate, Mike Pence, describes himself as an evangelical Catholic. So when you look at the leadership of the U.S. political process, you can see why people are wondering about Catholics, their political clout, where do they come down, what are they going to advance, what moral values are they going to take, etc. And this becomes a major bone of contention for many people who are concerned about the numbers of Catholics and the influence of Catholics in the political process. Now, the Catholic Church expects that Catholic politicians and Catholic actors will act in a certain way because they are Catholic. Okay. And so if you read some of the writings of the popes in encyclicals, or if you look at the writings of the Catholic bishops, okay, there are essentially certain things that are expected of Catholic political actors. Okay. When John Kennedy was running for president, he made a speech before the Houston ministers in which he said, if he ever was in a position where he had to choose a policy that questioned his Catholicism and his responsibility to his constituents as president, he would choose that he would do what his oath of office required of him. But he couldn't, he said he couldn't imagine any situation. Well, that was 1960, it was before 1973 and the passage of Roe v. Wade, which at that point put Catholic politicians in a very different situation. So that what is expected of Catholic politicians or actors, and if you pull together many of the different writings, I've tried to synthesize them, okay, that Catholics are expected to be politically involved. This is considered to be a moral obligation for every Catholic to be politically involved. This is a moral obligation that Catholics should attempt to put their moral values into the political marketplace. It's expected that they will be morally coherent, that they will support laws in a coherent and consistent way. So if you are pro-life, then your decisions about pro-life issues should be from the moment of conception to the moment of natural death. And all of the life decisions that are made in between that deal with issues like euthanasia, IVF, death with dignity, stem cell research, abortion, all of these are life issues. And the church expects that politicians and political actors will be morally coherent in the way they support the laws and morally consistent in their support of these policies. And the church expects that Catholic politicians would be willing to witness to their own faith, that they would be willing to stand up and say, yes, I am a Catholic, and therefore I do believe this. Now, one of the problems, however, is that there were many organizations within the Catholic Church itself. These organizations talk about advancing moral policies. But now I'm going back to that whole notion about the myth of the Catholic vote when I look at the diversity of a variety of different groups. For example, you know, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops speak out on policies, make policy decisions every single day, and they speak out on them, you know, widely, openly. They pass policy bills, they go to the Hill and they advocate on behalf of specific pieces of legislation, etc. But their word is not the last word, because there are also other groups of people. For example, nuns. These, we find that religious women have also organized politically. Network, they're known as the nuns on the bus, okay? And they go around and they speak to certain issues. The Leadership Conference of Women Religious do the same thing. The Little Sisters of the Poor have brought a lot of legislation before the courts regarding the Affordable Care Act and challenging it. The Knights of Columbus, this is a very large organization of men. They essentially are involved in insurance for the Catholic Church, but they have their policies. Other groups, Legatus, they talk about ethics and business organizations and ethical policies in business and Catholic ideas in business. The Catholic League talks about how to protect against discrimination against Catholics. You have SNAP and VOTF, Bishop Accountability, these organizations that talk out about Catholic clerical sexual abuse. they have very different policies from the church on how to deal with this particular issue. There are groups called the Catholic Climate Covenant who are very involved on behalf of the environment and the care of creation. You have CACP, Catholics Against Capital Punishment, which is another diverse group within the Catholic family who are involved in the political process. You have Catholics for Choice. These are Catholics who are pro-choice, who are definitely opposed to the Catholic stance on pro-life, but yet there's a place for them also within the Catholic Church. And then Opus Dei and People of Praise. This is an organization to which Amy Coney Barrett and her family belong. But these are all different organizations who support diverse policies within the Catholic Church. So when you say, you know, is there a Catholic vote? You know, I have to say the Catholic vote is really a myth because of, first of all, how people self-describe as Catholics. And secondly, who are some of these different groups that also are involved in the political process? So after all is said and done, okay, what are the moral principles that are expected in public policy choices? The fact that some acts are intrinsically evil, like abortion and euthanasia, and they should be rejected, that all threats to life must be rejected, that even a good end does not justify an immoral means to achieve it, and that opposing evil and doing good are essential obligations and dual responsibilities, and that all life issues are connected and are a priority. So, that said, then, those are some of the things I wanted to discuss. And I'm hoping now we can have some discussion of these issues and what they're about. And let's come back then to any questions that you might have. And we can now begin to answer some questions and have discussion. Okay.
Thank you so much, Dr. Formicola. There's a little bit of time before the first questions are coming in. And so
okay.
I'd like to develop a question for you, Dr. Formicola. The news cycle today shared information about a documentary film featuring Pope Francis on a very key issue, gay marriage. And the Pope appears to be making a distinction between civil unions and marriages, and is speaking, in the documentary clip at least, spoke in support of civil unions. How do you think that is going to impact U.S. law? One of the Pope's evangelical movement and maybe some Catholic movements is to work against the legalization of gay marriage in the U.S. And Pope Francis is clearly he's talking about civil unions, not marriages. But he did say that everyone has a right to a family. Do you think that revelation at this time, this close to the election, might have an impact?
No, I don't. Basically, I think that when the Pope talks about a policy like civil unions, there he's talking about a political issue. Okay. That's very different from speaking about a religious issue. Okay. So the Pope can talk about political issues all he wants. He has a geopolitical platform to do that, obviously. But if you start talking about gay marriage, as marriage, which becomes a sacramental or a religious issue, you're talking about something totally different. And so we know that in the United States, civil unions have been rejected because they're not considered to be equal to marriage. And therefore, the Supreme Court has ruled on that. But, you know, the Pope does not speak here as a political person when he is giving an interview or being asked about a political issue. That doesn't bind Catholics because he's not talking here ex cathedra or talking about any kind of doctrine or theology.
Okay. Thank you for a clear and concise answer. The myth of the Catholic vote was a clear thesis. And I appreciated your clarity and really understood the diversity of Catholics. Even bigger might be a myth of a Christian vote, where Catholics get lumped together with evangelicals and Protestants and so on. Is it to the point where we should ask pollsters and news agencies to just cut it out, to not lump all those things together?
I think so. You know, people assume that Catholics and evangelicals will work in a political coalition, but that isn't necessarily the case. You know, 5% of the population is evangelical. And as I said, about 23% are Catholic. Now, if they could work in coalition and you had 50%, almost 50% of the people on the same page working together, they could probably control much of the political process and public policy. But unfortunately, that is not the case. They don't do that. They can't do that because of the various and sundry splintered groups within Catholicism. Evangelicals are much more together or work in a group together because of where they are geographically, because of their ethnicity, because of their particular, even their economic status. They have so many more things pulling them together than Catholics. And so thus far, it's not working. Let's put it that way.
Okay, good. Thank you for that clear answer. You mentioned how the church is often thought of as an end-all, be-all moral compass. But what does that mean in politics in 2020, where not everyone believes in these values of the church, such as the Supreme Court and politicians being Catholics? Should we be scared that their views will leak into policies?
I would say no, only because when you look at the leadership, you know, Nancy Pelosi, who's Speaker of the House, is pro-choice, you know, and Joe Biden is pro-choice. Yet on the other hand, the president himself, who is not a Catholic, is pro-life. So that I think there were so many things that go into making these decisions, into each person's personal conscience. It's extremely difficult to say, well, because this person is a Catholic, they're always going to vote this way, or they're always going to go this way on a particular issue. Again, as I said, there are many cafeteria Catholics who pick and choose what it is they're going to support or how they're going to support it. And so I don't think it necessarily stands that because a person says they're Catholic, they're going to come in a certain issue. And I will tell a story. I don't like to tell war stories, but I do have a war story here. I was at Mass a couple of Sundays ago when the nomination of Amy Comey Barrett came out. And I saw a woman in my parish who, for every single Sunday when Notre Dame plays football, she wears a green sweater. And she comes in, she is Bula Bula. She went to Notre Dame, okay? And, you know, she's always rooting for the team, et cetera. And so I saw her and I said, gee, I bet you're really happy that somebody from, you know, Notre Dame Law School got this nomination from the president. And she said, I couldn't be more disappointed because of her particular stance on abortion. And I kind of stood back and I realized suddenly it hit home to me that not every Catholic is, you know, pro-life, even though they might have gone to Notre Dame and support the football team and give this overt appearance of being, you know, in the Catholic pocket, so to speak. That isn't really necessarily the case. So I don't think that person should be worried.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Formicola. It's a anecdote that really proves your points about diversity among Catholics. Let's go on to our next question here. I thought it was interesting that President Trump has claimed that if Biden is elected, the United States will have, quote, no God. Should this be surprising or not? In other words, do you think Trump's statement reflects a trend for liberal Catholics to be framed as not real Catholics by conservatives?
I don't think so. I think a lot of this, you know, you're the communications expert. I do teach campaign management, so I'm very big on optics and language and the picture that's the image that's presented. And I think a lot of this is rhetorical. You know, these people are on the stump. They're saying things to try to catch anybody's attention about anything. And so I don't know how much credence I would put into that. You know, I don't think that the United States is suddenly going to go, you know, atheistic because somebody is elected. That, you know, people have their traditions, they have their values, they have their religious beliefs, and they don't just go away because of who is president at any particular time.
That's a great answer.
Thank you.
How do Catholic Democrats reconcile this dilemma? And I think the dilemma might be the diversity amongst Catholics.
Well, I don't know that the dilemma is the diversity among Catholics. I think the dilemma is the question of pro-life.
Okay.
I think that might be the dilemma. You know, Democrats have always been the party of Catholics. I mean, if you look through history, I mean, JFK was a Catholic, and most people who were in the Democratic Party clearly were Catholics. They were blue-collar Catholics, or they were, you know, union leaders and union people who were Catholics. And then suddenly, once we come to Roe v. Wade, the people who are, you know, the party of the Catholics suddenly take a stance that is not Catholic. And, you know, how do they reconcile this? I don't know. I think this is part of the problem with a lot of politicians today. I think it's surprising that if you look back in the last 20 years, George Bush was pro-life, but he was not Catholic. John Kerry ran for president. He was pro-choice, but a Catholic. And I think the belief that you can't win an election if you are pro-choice, pro-life, and you follow your particular conscience, which might be the Catholic notion of standing up for life from the moment of conception, I don't think that necessarily loses your possibility of becoming president of the United States when we have had individuals in the last 20 years who have been pro-life but have not been Catholics.
Okay, good. Thank you for the history on those candidates and presidents. Our next question is on a similar issue, but aims at the Supreme Court. So Do you believe the ruling of Roe v. Wade will be brought to the Supreme Court if Judge Barrett is confirmed?
So I stand in a very different place than everybody else on this particular issue. First of all, I think that Roe v. Wade will never, ever be totally destroyed. It will never go away. I think people have to recognize the fact that Roe v. Wade is a legal decision, but the decision to have an abortion or not to have an abortion is a personal decision. And if you are opposed to abortion, well, then you don't just have to have an abortion. I think the only difference here is that people who are concerned about this ruling are probably concerned, or maybe just one of the reasons why they're concerned is because they're concerned that women who can't afford to have abortions will be locked out of the right to make that choice because of funding, et cetera. But I don't think that Roe v. Wade will ever be overturned. If you look at the history of the Supreme Court, I can think of maybe five cases that were overturned. Maybe Dred Scott was one of them. Aguilar versus Felton is another. But as far as overturning this case, I doubt that it would happen. I think it could be limited. And I think, you know, the amount of time that a woman can have an abortion might be pushed back. But I don't think the decision itself would be turned back. I also think, in a way, this is almost a moot question when you look at the fact that individuals can stop procreation themselves at home with things like RU 486, with the day after pill. There are so many other new technologies that I don't think that abortion itself can ever be completely and totally stopped, either by a legal opinion or by technology.
Thank you for that one. That's the personal choice element is key. And then the history of the Supreme Court overturning is a good statistic to keep in mind. Okay, next we have, in my Christian ethics class, we talked about the consistent life ethic and Pope Francis's throwaway culture. Do you have any more information or comments on that?
Well, I'm very concerned about this whole notion of cancel culture, that if somebody says something that you don't like or you find threatening or intimidated by it, well, you just run away from it. And I don't think that's the way to respond. I think, especially at the university, I think the university has to be the place where we encourage discussion. It's the place where we have to not tell people what to think, but how to think. And I think that's our job. And I think too many people in a classroom think that their classroom is a platform to tell people what to think. I think our job is to say, okay, how did you arrive at this particular opinion or this particular decision? Let's look at it. What did you use empirical evidence? Did you use some kind of sacred writing? What, you know, this is what we need to do. And I think if we do this, we can have greater respect for the fact that people of good faith can have different opinions and different beliefs, both political, religious, ethical, et cetera. But it doesn't mean that because somebody doesn't think the way you think that they're wrong. That isn't necessarily the case. I think understanding the socialization, that process that goes into making a person's political makeup or ethical makeup or religious makeup is extremely crucial in understanding how we can be different. And it doesn't mean that someone who thinks differently from us is, and there are certain words that are just not allowed in class, obviously. But in the political science class, my students can argue and debate and discuss any political policy they want. I don't care what it is. And we will get to the basis of why they've reached the decision that they've reached. But the one thing they cannot do is make ad hominem arguments and call a political person stupid or ignorant or racist or a misogynist. There's no room for that. You can pull any policy apart that you want to, but you cannot call names or use derogatory terms as a reason for why you think what you think. It's just not acceptable.
That's such a great explanation of educational ethics. I really appreciate it. And if anyone hasn't read Pope Francis's new encyclical yet, Fratelli Tutti, he directly engages cancel culture right in chapter one and says many similar things to what Dr. Formicola does. Differences, views are to be expected and really engaged and could be an opportunity for clarification of thought and learning. And trying to cancel someone out and really prevent them from having a voice or even existing is really kind of contrary to many, many values. And then I really do have to ask my own question at this point, Dr. Formicola. You did a great job talking about how ad hominem attacks are completely against constructive dialogue, especially in the classroom. When we have political leaders who regularly engage in ad hominem attacks and overall foster a culture of critique over a culture of unity, what are we supposed to do?
I think, you know, my feeling is this, and I know this is crazy because I'm a political junkie, okay? I admit that. Okay. But in the course of a day, the first thing I do when I get up, I listen to the news, okay? So I listen to Fox, I listen to CNN, and I listen to MSNBC for starters, okay? Then I go downstairs, I have a cup of coffee, and that's when I read the New York Times, and we also get the Wall Street Journal at my home. When I'm driving to school, I listen to 101.5 and I get the New Jersey News. My feeling is that every individual is responsible for coming to their own views about people and what truth is, what fake news is, and what civility is. And it is very, very upsetting to me when I hear people calling names or giving people nicknames or being bullies or whatever. You know, this to me is not civility. This to me is not real politics. To me, you know, I'm an Aristotelian and I love Plato as well. I think politics is a noble calling. I think politics is public service first. And that's what I think today's politicians tend to forget. They're so busy raising money and doing fundraising and trying to get on TV and make their image known and whatever. Political science and politics and what we talk about is really public service. And if we talk about public service, then we don't talk about ourselves. We talk about other people and their needs and their wants.
That's another great answer. You made me think of Pope Francis's new encyclical once again. So the political section is toward the end, and he does talk about politics as a noble profession and pursuit of the common good, and important. And so really, if anybody hasn't read it yet, just please go to Vatican.va. Right. It's right in the top right. And, you know, of course, click on the English translation. But it's encyclical, really help us face some current problems. Okay, our next question. I also thought and thoroughly enjoyed Dr. Formicola's breakdown, exclamation point. As a Catholic student, how should we balance voting with Catholic morals, but against rhetoric that pushes for divisiveness and hate?
Well, if I had the answer to that, I wouldn't be doing my day job. Trust me. You know, I've spoken to numbers of groups of young people who are continually trying to figure out what to do in the political process. I do teach Catholics in the political process. I'll put in a little note here. I'm teaching that next semester. And, you know, what we do in that course is we look at so many different issues from so many different points of view. And again, as I say, it's not my job to tell somebody, you know, what to do. I can only give you benefit of what I've learned through the work that I do, through my own research, through painstaking attempts to try to reconcile my own conscience and to become the person that I want to be, that I think I should be. And I can only let students know that, you know, this is a journey. Faith is a journey. And decision-making is a journey. We don't get it right every time. None of us, we're human beings. But all we can do is try our best, and then no one can fault us for the decisions that we come to.
Thank you for that one again, Dr. Formicola. It's if it's easy, we're probably doing it wrong.
So. I know.
Okay, our next question. Last year, there was a speaker at Seton Hall who talked about the Solidarity Party, which, while not a Catholic political party per se, seems to reflect a consistent ethic of life. Do you see more Catholics gravitating to a party like this, given that many Catholics don't feel that the two major parties adequately reflect authentic Catholic teaching?
I don't see this in the United States. I think we have a system that has evolved through our history and through the social traumas that we've been through, where the two main parties have essentially gained control of the entire electoral process. They are in business to keep themselves alive and to keep themselves as the only two parties in this country. They're in a position where they write the rules and the laws and the regs about how parties can become significant. They're in a position to continually control themselves. And I don't really see the way a movement can become a party. Bernie Sanders talked about his movement. It's a movement. Black Lives Matter, it's a movement. But as far as these movements becoming part of a third party, you know, even the people who called themselves the Tea Party, they were never a party. They were a movement. I just don't see that actually happening and becoming significant. Libertarians call themselves a party, but they really, again, the two parties consider their umbrellas large enough to be able to take in all thoughts and to be all things to all people. And as long as, you know, we have a term and a theory, it's called Diverger's theory. And basically what it is that all questions have two sides to them, and therefore we end up with two political parties. We have a system where, you know, it's winner take all, and that we don't have a system whereby you have a multi-party representation like you do in England and Europe and a lot of other places. And as long as that system exists, those two parties are going to do everything possible to maintain their own power and their own control over the establishment of any other party in this country.
Okay, so that's I think, accurate description of our political reality. Is mm-hmm. that problematic?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, because so many movements have such great potential. The Green Party, for example, or Black Lives Matter as a party, or, you know, Bernie Sanders and the Socialist Party. I mean, all of these people have ideas that should come to the public forum. I mean, what is it that John Stuart Mill says? Every idea has some kernel of truth or value in it. And if they can't get the platform to somehow be represented in the governmental structure, these ideas are never going to move forward. I mean, you only have to look at the Democratic Party right now to see how far it's gone to the left and how the left and the establishment are trying to come together in order to be able to hold the party together. You know, how much can they give to each other in order to maintain that umbrella over them? And the same is true in the Republican Party right now. You know, how far can the right go and still hold that umbrella together? I mean, we're watching these parties desperately try to keep their coalitions in place in order to be able to control the political process.
Thank you. Our next question ties a little bit to Dr. Polito's talk, and so I'm so glad you were here to be able to bridge these two talks. Even though the Catholic Church takes the standpoint that they are non-ideological actors, do you think that they play a role in the individual's ideological thinking? Our last speaker, Dr. Polito, talked about the unknown knowns. Could the doctrine of the church change how someone would view a certain issue if that person falls into the category of cultural or non-practicing Catholic?
You know, I don't know, because one of the questions I have to ask is, you know, if you look at all these statistics from the Pew Forum and all these other places that talk about, you know, religion and public life, I really have to ask myself, what role does religion play in a person's decision when they walk into the voting booth? And as long as I have been studying this and reading all kinds of Catholic documents and the bishop's documents, etc., although it seems to me that what they are looking for is simply that the Catholic doctrine be a consideration, one of the things to be considered when you walk into the voting booth. I don't think that the Catholic Church thinks that this has to be the main deciding factor. I think they are pragmatic enough to realize if they at least get on the radar screen, they have a chance of maybe getting some of their issues considered when an individual walks into the voting booth. I mean, when an individual walks into the voting booth, they have to figure out things about their health, their economy, their children, their education, you know, where they live. You know, there are so many things that enter into the decision-making process that what the church says is, if we can just teach people to be prudent and to be courageous and to think about these kinds of issues, then we have done our job. And I just think that's about the best that you can hope for when a Catholic or any religious person walks into a voting booth.
Thank you, Dr. Formicola. Seeing that we're at 6:05 and we've got one more substantive question. And so I think we're really on track.
Oh, great. Okay.
So here we go. The church is supposed to be nonpartisan, and yet Catholic priests and other leaders spoke at both the RNC and DNC. Shouldn't the church advise against this? Further, there is an argument among many Catholic Republicans that it is a sin to vote for a Democratic candidate. Even some priests have said this, and yet neither of the parties or candidates support completely pro-life policies. How can this rhetoric be changed?
So in 1984, Cardinal, I can't remember which cardinal it was giving a homily. Geraldine Ferraro was the vice presidential candidate. And he gave his homily and he spoke about pro-life issues, etc. He came out of the cathedral and said, I don't see how anybody could vote for Geraldine Ferraro. Okay. And that basically was a partisan statement. Okay. The claim, however, was that when he came out of the church, when he was standing on the church steps, he wasn't talking as the cardinal. He was talking as, you know, Joe Schmo, John Smith, Joe Sixpack. He's a citizen as well. And so I think it depends on the context where these statements are being made. Are they being made from the inside the church as part of a homily where there is some partisan statement? Or is this something that's being said at a cocktail party or you know, at some kind of a church picnic or wherever, where the priest is just a citizen and makes these kinds of statements. So, yeah, there very definitely there's a big distinction when you talk about the context of where these things are said.
Great, thank you. I'm not seeing any other questions, but I do have to say that there's a comment that I think a lot of people agree with, and I will. I am loving her answers.
Oh, how sweet. That's so nice. Okay, I love it. Okay. I try to be the pragmatist. You know, it's tough. You know, as I said, my office is right next door to Dr. Polito, and, you know, he's, you know, Mr. Ideological and philosophy and so and legal. So I have to come at it from my other perspective. But we have wonderful lunches and wonderful talks. And that's the nature of what academia should be and the classroom should be and all of us when we discuss these very difficult situations. So it's been my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So as we come to the end of our event today, I of course want to thank Dr. Formicola and then all the behind-the-scenes people that helped make this possible. So Burke Loxley at TLTC is a wonderful producer. Asia Robinson is a wonderful graduate assistant. And Lorraine Joyce is an expert at PR and marketing. In the bigger picture, I'd like to thank the College of Communication and the Arts and Dean Yates for sponsoring this institute. We are the Institute for Communication and Religion, and we're in our fourth year now, and we try to do good, important work like this. Thank you all for a wonderful day.
Thank you.